From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made shortly after you were born. Your parents had to make a decision. What should they teach you about religion? Should they raise you to belong to any particular faith or not? What will the impact be of raising a child to be one religious faith over another? What will the impact be of raising a child to not have faith in a deity? A new book takes aim at religious upbringings. Dan Errol is the author of Parenting Without God, How to Raise Moral, Ethical, and Intelligent Children Free from Religious Dogma. His book has gotten some buzz, so we wanted to talk with him about it. And he is on the line with us now. Dan, nice to welcome you to Connections. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Also with me in studio are a pair of guests with a different set of views, I think, even though I suspect, as Reverend Sittig told me, we may agree on, the panel may agree on more than they disagree on. Reverend Scott Sittig is the lead pastor at New Hope Free Methodist Church. And Reverend Sittig, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Letterman is an associate professor of spiritual formation at Northeastern Seminary. And Rebecca, nice to have you as well.
Thank you.
Our only ground rules are feel free to disagree and just do so civilly. Mm-hmm. And I think that'll be an easy one because all three of our panelists here are people who are used to having, you know, nice, firm, civil, but, you know, as we said, firm conversations. So I want to start with Dan, whose book is out now. It's Parenting Without God. And Dan, you know, you start right with a question on what parents should teach children about religion, and you are blunt about it. You compare modern religions to Greek mythology, saying that we teach those ancient religions as fiction, and we should do that to modern religions as well, yes?
Yeah, that's pretty much sums it up pretty well. Yeah, I view, you know, all religion as stories, whether people take those as moral stories or absolute truth or whatnot. They're not really, in my worldview, they're not seen that way. They're fiction, and I don't necessarily want to tell a kid, you know, what you believe is not true. Like, that's not my method of talking to somebody, but I'm not going to raise my kid to think that it's true or might be true when I have a pretty firm belief that modern religion as we see it today is not.
Okay, but as an atheist, Dan, you do not advocate that parents keep religion out of their child's education, right?
That's correct. I think that's that would be a really big mistake because religion is a part of everyone's life. We all know religious people from many different religious backgrounds. We know atheists, we know Buddhists. I mean, you can go on and on. And I think they should know about it because they also need to know that they should respect people, even if they don't believe in the same thing they believe. And you can't do that if you don't understand what other people believe. So I believe in being honest about people's beliefs and not trying to distort them dishonestly, like some people tend to like to do, which will give people the wrong impression about what a religion is. And that happened to me even when I was religious. I went to a Christian school and I was taught very incorrectly about Judaism and other religions, which gave me a warped view of them growing up for a while.
Just elaborate a little bit on that. Warped in what way, Dan?
I was told, you know, well, yeah, they believe in a quote-unquote God, but not correctly. And I was taught weird things about, like, their beliefs, like why, you know, well, they wear yarmulkes because, you know, it's their way of connecting to God. Or, you know, I can't remember the exact wording. And I remember a girl in my class raised her hand and said, well, what happens if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're scared and you need to pray and you're not wearing it? My teacher said, I don't know, you just grab a napkin or something.
Maybe not, hopefully,
and,
not know, representative of all education.
Like that. They hate at you. They're wrong.
All right, so maybe hopefully not representative of all education, but let me ask our panelists in studio then. So Dan's approach, Rebecca, is to teach children about religion as myth, as story. What's your approach? What do you think is effective?
Well, one thing I would start out saying is that I agree with Dan in the sense that I think it's really important that we always begin with respect, and so it's important for us. Part of respect is learning to hear one another, listen to one another, learn what each other's values are. So I, too, even though I come from a Christian perspective, have sought to parent and teach in my case, one child, mm-hmm. To understand all different kind of religions as well and to do so as accurately as possible. So I think that's part of what truth-telling is. I would think that most religions, whatever they would be, are going to, and even atheism, is going to start hopefully from a position of truth-telling. And so what that is about, what that looks like, lots of different things to lots of different people. So how do we listen to others, and how do we explore that for ourselves?
And Rebecca, is there a concern of yours that if you choose to raise a child on any particular religion, but to the exclusion of any information about others, in other words, you say in your own case as a mother, you wanted education sort of across the spectrum of beliefs, even if you're raising a child to be of one particular religion. Mm-hmm. Is there a risk that involved with not allowing education of other religions, information, et cetera?
Well, I think one of the risks is something not unlike Dan's experience, where then at some point when that person, this child, or when they grow older, discovers other things that, in a sense, you have perhaps hidden from them, mm-hmm. or not been honest about, then that creates a difficulty in terms of your own veracity and how you're perceived.
Okay. Reverend Sittig, let's talk about your approach then. What do you think is effective in terms of raising children?
You know, as a father of five, I kind of come at this from multiple perspectives because, you know, every child brings a different learning style and learning structure and the way they approach things to the world. It's been fun to try and adapt my own parenting to each and every one of my children. One of the core values that my wife and I instilled from the very beginning was the fact that we wanted our children to love to learn. And learning involves learning. I mean, learning is across the board. We don't learn one thing. Like, that's not learning. You know, you learn about something. But true learning is really looking at all aspects of life and looking at the ways things, have come about, looking at history, looking at science and exploring the mysteries and wonders of science and looking at how other people have adapted to this world. And so from a religious perspective, we've been very open about wanting to understand how people have viewed God in other contexts. And of course, at every different level, the kids have a different capacity of how to process that. But I'm not afraid, and we've never been afraid of letting our kids explore and walk through that with them, because I agree with Dr. Letterman that at some point, one of the biggest reasons kids fall away when they go to college, you know, there's big statistics about kids falling away when they go away to college because they don't have any foundation to stand on. They've only been taught one thing, and then they get out in a world and they're like, oh, wow, what's this world about? And I don't want my kids to get out there and have these doubts and these questions that you know, could have been explored and understood in the context of home. So that's the approach that we've taken. We love to explore. God's creation is so big and there's so much about it. So we take that tack.
And so I think that, Dan, maybe there's at least a little bit of common ground between you and then our two studio panelists, because a significant part of your book is a concern about oppression that can come when, let's say, a government entity is sort of quasi-theocratic or creating public policy based on a single religious set of values, or a large societal block is one religion versus another. Because as you write, if you are not in that religious group, you can be oppressed, you can be sort of cast out. You are very specific about gay people, for example, in your book, and you're concerned about them. Are you concerned that that raising kids to be religious is going to lead to that kind of oppression?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that very much depends on the household. Listening to your two in studio guests, I don't get that either of them are going to raise children that are going to grow up to oppress people. I don't know your personal views on gay marriage and et cetera, but I think it really can. And if you have a religion that's dominant, and, you know, Christianity has a very big dominance in the U.S., it tends to lead to the whole in-group, out-group. And that's one thing I'm hoping to try to eliminate, is that it doesn't have to be, in-group, out-group, a mentality in our country and around the world. Is that I want my kids to look at Christians and see them as just people that believe something differently, even though they might think that they're wrong. And I don't know, my kids might grow up to be Christians, they could grow up to be Jewish, I don't know. I'm not kind of pushing them in either direction, but what I'm doing is letting them know that we're all the same, we're all equal, but we can't let certain beliefs that we hold rule how we dictate society, I guess is the best way of kind of trying to say that.
Okay. Dan, are you more concerned with parents who are raising kids to be of one particular faith in an almost exclusionary fashion, you know, not learning about others and in a way that some view as, I think exclusionary is the right word, of other thoughts and other
systems? Yeah, I'm concerned. It's, you know, my concern is the very extreme fundamentalism of it. We're right, they're wrong. And often their wrong comes with they're dangerous because they're wrong. They're going to try to convert you. They're going to tempt you. And it becomes this very, we're good, they're bad. And that tends to stem, I think, from the fundamentalist side of all religions, really. And all, you know, all different kinds of ideologies, even outside of religion, is the whole mentality of, you're going to learn about this. This is absolutely true. Questioning it is not a good thing. The Reverend said that he wants his children to explore and question and have doubts and explore them now is great. That's a very positive way of parenting. I've come across too many people who have either are currently in religion or have left because of it where they don't have that opportunity and they're kind of sheltered from the outside world.
Well, let me go ahead and we've had a number of listener comments already on Twitter. And listeners, if you want to call the program and talk about, you know, sort of your own thoughts about constructive ways to raise kids as we have a conversation about whether we ought to be raising kids to think in secular, sort of skeptical fashion or raising them to be of one religion or another, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. On Dan's point, I think most of the feedback I've gotten from listeners on Twitter, or at least maybe a plurality, have been people who were raised in a religious setting and have some appreciation or affection for it for different reasons, whether or not they have maintained that belief system. But here is a comment from Rick on Twitter who says, I was raised to fear my own thoughts, as all individual thoughts were taught to be not of God, sinful, selfish. It's very hard to look back at my childhood and find appreciation amidst the suppression of even thinking for myself. Dan, it sounds like that's what you're concerned about most.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, he kind of nailed my fear for children. The fear for my children and all children is that they're afraid to ask a question. They're afraid to think differently than me. I want my children to even question something I tell them and say, you know what, I think you're wrong. Because I was able to do that with my parents, and I think that helped me greatly growing up. I think all children should have that. They should be able to say, you know, Mom, Dad, I think you're wrong. If you're raised to be afraid of thinking or even of your thoughts that you don't even speak getting you in trouble, that's a terrible way to grow up and live.
You're hearing Dan Errol, who is the author of the new book, Parenting Without God. And let me turn to Reverend Sittig then. You know, what would you say to someone like Rick, who says he looks back at his childhood and feels like he had to fear and suppress his own kind of individual thoughts and questions and was taught that questions were wrong and not of God?
Yeah, I really feel for him. You know, I feel for the struggle that put on him as a child trying to come up and discern and try to figure out life. Life is so big, and I suppose one of the things that I've often thought about God and kind of come, the God that I believe in, the God of the Bible, is that God is big enough to handle these questions. You know, the fact that I would ever be told that I couldn't ask them or that my doubts somehow would signify a lack of belief even, the God that I believe in is so much bigger than that, and I've felt the freedom and the journey to explore that, and for those that don't have that, sometimes I believe that can paint a picture of the church that leaves a very negative impression for a lot of people about the church. But I guess what I'd like to say is that's not universal. That's not the whole church, and I often encourage the youth that I work with, my own kids, people in my own church, you know, we can't paint a picture of who God is by just looking at the church, because people, we're all human. We're all sinful in that sense. We're all fallible, I guess is the word to think of. But God is different. God is bigger. And we have to begin as the church to paint that picture that God is outside of what we see, what the church looks like in our world, and begin to paint the picture of who God really is. And exploring that is part of what we try to work through.
And to be fair, Rebecca Letterman, many of our listeners have said things like, here's Chelsea, I went to Catholic schools, but my family is not religious. It was a good balance seeing the other side. Makes you more tolerant. Norma writes, Catholic school for 12 years. It was expensive, but I believe it essential to my academic and social development. Plus, my faith still lives. Kat says, my dad told us to be involved religiously would help us build connections in the community, and I thank him for that to this day. So I don't want to imply that Rick's comment was sort of indicative. In fact, a little bit of an outlier there. We've had a few comments that are kind of along those lines. Steve writes to us, despite good intentions, my parents did raise me to be religious, and that led to a distorted view of the world I've had to overcome as part of a maturing process. So a diversity of feedback. But Rick's comment that I mentioned, it lined up with some of Dan's concerns. But it sounds to me, like, Rebecca, like you agree with Reverend Sittig, that Rick's feeling is not a healthy one for a child to have.
Absolutely. And just one other follow-up thought is that it also, this conversation indicates a certain understanding of parenting that in some sense is almost a one-way direction. And so what I like about what Dan said is that if you're a kind of parent that understands the parent-child relationship as multidirectional, then being asked questions about what you as a parent believe is a healthy thing that you welcome.
Uncomfortable, but healthy.
I would hope so.
It's uncomfortable, but it's a healthy thing.
I would hope so. As I've said on Twitter this morning, I think people are worthy of respect. Ideas are worthy of scrutiny. And,
yes.
You know, some ideas are worthy of respect. Some are worthy of more scrutiny. And I think we have to be able to do that in a way that is respectful, but also we shouldn't feel personally attacked if someone is probing our ideas. Mm-hmm. And maybe even as parents, Dan Errol, yes?
Yeah, I think very much so. Yeah, that's one thing I've kind of, as an atheist, I get attacked a lot if I say something about religion that I hate religious people. That's usually a go-to argument, is that, you know, I don't know why you hate Christians. And, you know, I don't hate Christians, I think, you know. I'm sure there are Christians I dislike, but there's atheists I dislike. There's everyone. There's people everywhere I dislike. But it's ideas that I'm criticizing and questioning. And, I think it gets tricky, though, because when you hold the belief, so even as a parent, there's things I believe that, you know, I hold dear. When someone questions them, I often can feel at that moment offended. And then you want to, you know, it's hard to break that up. And that's what I think we have to kind of get past that wall. My kid needs to be able to question me, even if it's uncomfortable and even if it's something I believe in. Other people need to be able to question me, and vice versa. And no matter how uncomfortable it makes you, if they're not attacking you personally or attacking your idea, you have to be able to defend your idea. Otherwise, it's not a good idea.
We are talking about Dan's book and related conversations, and the book is Parenting Without God, How to Raise Moral, Ethical, and Intelligent Children Free from Religious Dogma. Dan's taking the time to join us for the hour, as well as our guests in studio, Reverend Scott Sittig, the lead pastor at the New Hope Free Methodist Church, and Dr. Rebecca Letterman, an associate professor of spiritual formation at Northeastern Seminary. We're going to be working through more of your comments online and your phone calls as we go throughout the hour. I want to turn to what I think is another central portion of Dan's book, which is a concern about critical thinking. And Dan, maybe you can illustrate for our listeners your concern that if you raise a child to be of one specific religion, that might open the door to believing without evidence in other realms and not being, you know, a particularly skeptical person.
The point I'm trying to make is that a lot of times, and I was kind of in my Christian schooling and going to church a lot, I was more or less told what to think. That was one thing I kind of picked up on, and I still see a lot today, is children being told, you know, this is what's true. That's it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You believe this. So a lot of times it comes from parents that say, like, you know, here's my 4-year-old. She's a great little Catholic, but a 4-year-old can't decide to be a Catholic. A 4-year-old's told she's a Catholic. The same way I don't say my four-year-old is an atheist, even though he has no concept right now of what even a God is. So if you want to go book definition, sure, he doesn't believe in a God. He's an atheist. He's not. He hasn't made a decision. He's not old enough to make a decision. So I'm arguing that you need to be able to teach children how to think, not what to think. So we need to give them the tools to hear something. So if someone says to them, oh, there's a God, they can ask questions and probing questions to come to their conclusion on, is this person making a factual statement or not? Do I believe what this person's saying or do I reject it? And it shouldn't come from, well, my dad said that God doesn't exist, so he doesn't. I don't want my child to say that. I want my child to say, oh, well, why do you feel that way? And kind of probe and dig to the bottom. And I think that's oftentimes, and again, what I'm going to say is the more fundamentalist side of religion wants to take that away. They don't want children to ask those questions and be critical. They want children to just accept what the authority says and move on.
All right, but where I think our guests differ, because all three of our guests, who come from different perspectives, agree that asking questions, that probing, that being open-minded and learning about the world is valuable. I mean, everyone is agreeing on that. But Dan, are you saying it is almost inherent that if you raise a child in a religious fashion, that there is some erosion of skepticism, or that is inherently the risk?
I think it's inherently the risk because it's religion is making a truth claim to the world based mostly, almost fully, I guess, on faith. So if I was to say, how was the universe created? I'm very comfortable saying, I can say the Big Bang. If someone says, how was that? I don't know. I'm very comfortable saying I don't know. Where often in the religion side, you're going to get an answer. God did it. And then that's it. That's where the conversation stops. And I think that, to me, is a big problem. And that's one of the things I don't like about truth claims made by the religious is that they're so matter of fact. Well, God created the universe, but how do you know that? And there needs to be, Big Bang couldn't start without a creator. Well, who created the creator? And you go down this whole rabbit hole. But I think you lose that ability to really truly question things if you kind of have this default fallback answer that eliminates the I don't know.
Okay. Dr. Lederman, what do you think about that?
Well, as you said, I do agree with Dan that we want to, as parents, foster a questioning, exploring take on things. So I'm with him there. I think you're right that we do differ a little bit in assuming that religion per se across the board is going to limit that. And one of the ways I'd say that is you in a sense, everyone starts somewhere. So whether it is a religious perspective or other values that our culture gives us, because, for example, we're born in 21st century America, so there are certain things that our culture is embedded in just the way we live. So you begin somewhere. And in some sense, religion, as long as it is not particularly fundamentalist, narrow, if it is of the ilk where it will encourage exploration, then it should nurture a kind of reflection and questioning that will look at religion and at other cultural values and explore and question them. So I'm not sure it's fair to single out religion and say, if you have a religious background, you will not learn to think.
And I'm not sure that's exactly the argument, but what about a lack of curiosity then? Because part of Dan's argument is, this universe is an amazing thing. We don't have all the answers. As we go throughout time, we've gained more of an understanding. And are you concerned that if the answer generally is it starts with God, that fills in the gaps and it tamps down curiosity to continue the process of exploration and discovery?
I suppose that might be true if you think you have God figured out. But if you don't, then my experience is no, it actually doesn't. Actually, if you understand that you really don't understand God, then having God in the conversation already makes an exploratory conversation.
Okay, but before I turn to Reverend Sittig, one of the comebacks there is, well, you're sort of humbly claiming we don't have God figured out, and that's a humble and certainly a true thing. If there is a God, I would agree. Nobody really has God perfectly figured out. But religious texts do go a long way to claiming a lot of very specific things about God, right?
That's true.
I mean, and some, I'm sure Dan would argue, too far.
Obviously.
And especially the way they're presented, interpreted, and really the way they are passed on to a child in particular or to children. So that's fair. That's fair. But I think a lot of it has to do, indeed, with the actual approach, which is kind of what we've been touching on.
Okay. Reverend Sitting, what did you think about the concern about taking away intellectual curiosity when you're filling in a lot of what might eventually be proven by science or bared out by science? By saying, well, God created the universe, God did this, you know, et cetera. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that does show a lack of intellectual curiosity, you know, and I do think a lot of people fall back, and I've seen that. I've grown up in the church. I've seen a lot of people fall back on weak arguments that just, well, it must be God. And that's a lack of intellectual rigor, you know, because there's a lot that can be explained. With God as part of the equation, there's a lot that needs to be explored. There's a lot of science out there that explains anthropology and history, and you know, you take science and the rigors of science and biology, and you can dig and dig and dig, and there are some answers out there. I don't claim that we have all the answers. I don't think any religion, anybody, to Dr. Lederman's point, we don't have God figured out. We don't have all the answers. But neither do I think that God has to be eliminated from the equation, or that we can't explore this in the context of a religious, Christian even setting, because I think it actually demands a higher level of scrutiny from us, because the world is looking for those answers. And I think that's part of what we have, is that the world is looking. You know, there's this idea that there is something more out there. There is something bigger, and we sort of all have this sense in us that there's something else. And so we explore and we search, but to assume that you have to be intellectually weak to do that in the context of a church or a religion or something like that, I think is a false argument. It doesn't have to be. Does it exist? For sure. I would have to agree with Dan on that. It does exist. And there are a lot of places where kids aren't encouraged in those ways. I hope my home isn't one of them. And I don't think any of us on this panel here today are advocating that. But I do think that there's a lot of potential for digging and learning and growing in the context of a church.
All right, before I get to your phone calls, because the phones are lit up, Dan Errol, a response to what you just heard?
Yeah, you know, I like I said, I think it's great how much we can actually agree on our parenting tactics and questioning. But a fear I have with this is that you get to a point where, we're almost talking about almost like a God of the gaps, and I don't think that's the exact argument being made, but where, you know, as you keep looking back and we fill in these holes of things we don't know and they are explained very naturally, a fear I have when you are kind of adhering to a God belief is that when you get to the end and you have that one last question and you can answer it naturally, if that was to eliminate a God, that might be where the conversation stops. And that's what I see a lot, is that people get to a point where they can't accept evolution. They can't accept the Big Bang. And it's because to do so takes away a big part of what they believe God's role is. And if they eliminate that, then what do they believe in? And I think that's a really big inherent risk. And again, I think we are falling into a more fundamentalist side, because I do think, you know, there's a lot of great religious scientists out there who kind of, I want to say, quote unquote, put God on the shelf while they're researching, and they're looking at natural answers, and they're not saying God can or cannot be part of that conversation. They're looking at it naturally. But you run that risk that you're going to come to a point where you might eliminate, not necessarily eliminate that God could exist, but that he is needed in the natural, construction of the universe. And people might be hesitant to push further because that might eliminate what they believe.
All right, well, I want to go ahead and get our short break in, and then we'll come back to your phone calls, because a lot of people are waiting to weigh in on this subject from all different points of view. It's fascinating. Marianne writes to us on Twitter, "Great show today. When there's a question about God in our house, we say to the kids, what do you think about that? And great conversation ensues." But really a wide range of questions and comments, and we're going to be getting to your calls and comments as we continue with our panel. Reverend Scott Sitting, the lead pastor at the New Hope Free Methodist Church, Dr. Rebecca Lederman, an associate professor of spiritual formation at Northeastern Seminary, and Dan Errol on the line with us, who's the author of Parenting Without God, How to Raise Moral, Ethical, and Intelligent Children Free from Religious Dogma. Short break. Your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, the local interfaith community has postponed a planned rally and demonstration in favor of peace and against Islamophobia for Friday. We'll talk to them about why, in the wake of San Bernardino, they have decided to postpone and how they plan to advocate for peace going forward. Then second hour, it's all about reshaping Rochester and their 2015 awards. Talk with you Friday.
How far should we go to protect America from terrorist attacks? On The Next Fresh Air, Chris Whipple and Jules Naudet discuss their Showtime documentary, Spy Masters. They interviewed 12 former CIA directors about making life and death decisions and the Spy Masters' disagreements with each other about torture and drones. Join us.
This evening at 7 on WXXI.
All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's get to your phone calls. Paul in Brighton is first up. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, thanks. It's hard to prove that God exists. Rene Descartes made an attempt, I believe, at it when he said something like, I think, therefore I am, and he finally concluded a few paragraphs later with, therefore God exists. And of course, he was not being serious when he did that. It was really more, I think, it was a put-on to his readers. But secular humanism is just as much a religion as the major religions that we know of, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hindu, and so forth. All of them, including secular humanism, are based on the assumption that there's such a thing as human initiative, the ability to make a decision. This goes back, of course, to the old question of is there or is there not a free will. I think those who are familiar with science and have a good, solid science background, the kind we get in universities, would at least acknowledge that there is nothing in science to even suggest that such a thing as free will exists. It doesn't exclude it, obviously, but there's no empirical evidence that such a thing exists. This is, at best, a mechanistic universe, whether we call it Newtonian mechanics or relativistic mechanics or quantum mechanics or anything else. Everything in the universe, all the component parts, have a way of working. It's an inherent nature of materials and energy that there's a certain way it behaves. And this can be described in detail, but we don't have time for that now. So I'd like your reaction to that.
Yeah, Paul, thanks for the phone call. Dan Errol, my brain's in a pretzel on that because I'm thinking of what Sam Harris would say. Sam, an atheist writer who's written about free will and may agree with Paul on that point, but would probably vehemently disagree with the idea that secular humanism is no different than religion. What do you think, Dan?
I won't spend much time on free will. I mostly agree with Sam Harris on the illusion of free will. Getting to the bigger point there, No, secular humanism, I would say, falls more into an ideology rather than a religion because it lacks, number one, religion's number one kind of definition, and most dictionaries puts that there's a belief in a god or a deity first and foremost. But it is it's more or less, like I said, it's an ideology that kind of just provides maybe, I don't want to say moral guidance because you're not going to find secular humanists that agree on everything in that sense. But there's no set of rules. There's no doctrines to follow. It's more of an idea that we just need to treat everybody equally. And that means different things to different people. And it's kind of left at that. I would say it's closer to religion than anything else. But definition-wise, no. It's more of an ideological standpoint on how you just think other humans should be treated.
Okay. Reverend Sittig, Dr. Letterman, you want to weigh in on that? Go ahead, Dr. Letterman.
Well, there's a lot of debate. I'm not a religion scholar per se. There's a lot of debate about how to define a religion. One thing that came to mind as I was listening to Dan's comments, though, is that most religions are not simply dogma. It's not so much a mental assent to a set of ideas. That's often part of it, but it's usually somehow also couched in terms of some kind of an encounter with a deity. And so there's an experiential aspect to it that goes beyond a mental assent. And so I think in that sense, one might argue secular humanism is different from religions that would anticipate there being some kind of an encounter between a human and an other.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't disagree. I certainly would affirm with that, what Dr. Lederman's saying. You know, that there's it's really hard to find a religious perspective, a religious conviction on something that doesn't have some sort of a personal encounter with a deity, with a god of some sort. And when you abstract this discussion from that personal element, it changes the discussion significantly.
But what do you mean by a personal encounter?
Yeah, most religions, and I'll speak specifically of the Christian religion, I'm not a scholar in that sense, but most religions, the Christian religion is rooted in something that is a little bit different. It's not a set of rules. It's not a set of dogmas. It's not a set of ideologies. It's rooted in this personal relationship, personal encounter of something that is outside of myself, something that I perceive to be higher than myself, that helps give me a sense of purpose and meaning and the way I frame how I look at the world. There's just something more to this world than what I can see, what I can taste, what I can touch. There's something different. And a lot of folks, I can't say all religions experience this, but a lot of folks who are digging deeper and asking those tougher questions are rooting those questions in some sort of an experience that is helping to frame that or contextualize that for them, and they want to know more. And in that sense, it's producing this longing, this yearning, this searching. And I think that's where we try to root these conversations about digging deeper and critical thinking and understanding, because there's the sense that there is more to it.
I have a lot of comments coming. We're going to try between the next 15 minutes. We're going to try to get through as many as we can. Let's go ahead and let's get another phone call in before I go back to the emails, which have been coming in. And this is Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about, I've been a Baptist all my life. I was brought up a Baptist in the South. And I had always been taught that Jesus and them drink real wine, and that Jesus wouldn't hear a sinner's prayer. And then I was called into the ministry, and I did research myself just on those two particular things. Now, there was more, but I just did research on those two things. And I found out that in the Bible, there was two wines. One was fermented and one was unfermented. And then the one that was at Canaan was unfermented. And when they talk about the wine in the Bible, in most cases, it is just real sweet with no alcohol content in it whatsoever. And then when we talk about God won't hear sinners' prayer, that is wrong also, because we all were sinners before we were saved, and he heard our prayers and he delivered us. And I think one of the problems is people don't want to read the Bible for themselves and find the explanation to what they're reading. They just want somebody else to tell them. And you can't follow somebody just by going about what somebody says. You have to read it, study it, meditate, and find it for yourself. So I'll just wait and listen to your reply.
Okay, thank you, Sam. I am not an expert on the wine thing. And I've actually read just about, I think the... It's been a while since I read the Bible all the way through, but I've done it. I'm not an expert on the fermented, unfermented thing. Reverend Sittig?
Yeah, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to take the context of that question, and I'm going to say, you know, there's a verse in the Bible that I often use with my own children, and it's a verse in Acts that talks when Paul was talking to the people that he was talking to, the Bereans, and he said that the Bereans were of more noble character than a lot of the other people he was talking to, because they searched the scriptures, they did their own study, they tested everything that he said to see if it was true. And I think what the caller is getting at is that there's this context of, do we just take things at face value? Do we just always go by what we've been told? Or do we actually dig? Do we test? Do we push? Can this stand up under the weight of my own scrutiny? And I think that's what the caller's getting at, is that, yeah, there's a lot of things that a lot of people have been taught religiously and non-religiously. There's a lot of things. And the Bible actually commends those who test those things and push us as leaders of religious communities and churches and synagogues and things like that, mosques. Push back. Figure out, what does this scripture actually say? And this is across all religions. You know, we have a lot of assumptions about what Islam means, and a lot of people haven't really read the Quran. They don't really know what Islam says, and I'm not going to get into all of that, but I'm just saying that's the tenet of what we're talking about is critical thinking demands that we test all of these things, and I think that's the point that the caller is getting at.
Okay. Dan Errol?
Yeah, the caller touched on two things that I thought were really important. The first one being, it's correct, a lot of people... And again, this stems part of the, you know, the point of my book is that you're told something by an authority figure, a pastor, priest, you know, et cetera, and you don't question it. And a lot of people aren't like the caller who go and decide to research it. They hear it and they go, okay, well, it must be true because he said it and he's an authority figure. He knows the Bible better than I do, and they accept it. I think that becomes an issue. And in the religions or the, you know, the different religious sects that, you know, kind of condemn the whole questioning thing, that's a great tool for making sure people continue to believe what you tell them and follow your set of rules that you're putting forward through that religion. But he also mentioned, and I don't think he kind of meant to do it, was that, you know, we're all born sinners before we're saved. That's another thing that really irks me, is that there's this whole idea that we're born into sin because of something our father did, or something that you know, Adam and Eve did, and that we have to work for some sort of redemption. That really, really bothers me, that there's children out there, even adults out there, that believe that they're inherently bad or inherently sinners, and that they need to work for this forgiveness for something they never did wrong.
All right, well, Dan, I want to work in a listener email, and I'll let you answer it, and then I'll let our in-studio panelists respond. Anna wrote to us and says, does your guest book deal with sex? My concern about raising kids in a religious setting is they often get very bad views about sex, that God is always judging them. They become fearful of it, not empowered. And the answer is yes, Dan's book does deal with sex. Dan, go ahead and answer Anna's question.
Yes, I do deal with sex. Because I think that's something very important. When I was starting to write the book, I was in the midst of a pretty long-term debate, and I had done some podcast shows about a purity culture and how they're really kind of oppressing sexual freedom and questions about sex in that particular Christian community, and that when children are raised to think sex is this bad thing before you're married, or that there's, you know, that a woman's value is based on virginity, you wind up in a very weird place where girls don't value themselves properly. They don't value their bodies. Men don't quite, they don't understand the feelings they're having, and they don't know how to deal with them. And then you're told, you know, there's only the only safe sex is abstinence, and then you see in the communities that do that generally teen pregnancies and STD rates rise, because, you know, the truth is teens for the most part are going to have sex, or they're going to have sexual relationships of some kind, and they're not taught how to do so safely, and that's where problems arise. And I think that's a big chunk of my book is, you know, talking about you know, kind of breaking through those stigmas about sex and just being completely honest about sex and not making it to be some villainous thing that people do enjoy, but there's ways to do it properly and safely, and to make sure you're doing it for you and not for somebody else.
All right, Reverend Siddig, you've got five kids. Teaching about sex is not something any parent loves to do, but from a religious perspective, where would you agree or disagree with Dan Errol on that?
Well, I disagree in the sense that I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that kids are going to have sex. And I do think that kids have a lot of questions. We live in a sex-saturated society. It's all around us. If you're a kid or an adult, you are inundated with images and thoughts and all of these sorts of things. And it has forced me to have conversations with my own children at younger and younger ages. I mean, I've had conversations with all of them. It's an awkward conversation to have, but it's also welcome. And I remember being a kid myself and wanting somebody to just unpack what these feelings were, what these emotions were. How am I supposed to handle myself? Like, what do I do in certain contexts, in certain situations? The thought that we should just give kids free rein to just explore their feelings, I think even Dan mentioned, you got to give them certain tools to work with and understandings. And I do think that it's appropriate to have boundaries. And I think that it is okay to talk to them about the appropriate view of, in my case, for my young men, the appropriate view of women and how we value women and how we look at women. And for my daughter, the same thing, you know, how do we have this relationship and what are men made to be in the image of God and that sort of thing. So it's a tender, difficult subject, but one that needs to be had, one that all Christians should be having. And I don't think that it's a foregone conclusion that it's just something that everybody should be allowed to do.
I think just to follow, I think the reason that some feel that if it's foregone conclusion or close is because if you look at the numbers, we had a conversation recently about increased federal funding for abstinence-only education. And the 10 states that have the highest rates of unwanted teen pregnancy are a contiguous block of the South. Mm. And they have the highest levels of abstinence-only education. The 10 states with the lowest rates of unwanted teen pregnancy are a contiguous block from Minnesota to Maine. Mm-hmm. And they have they essentially don't fund abstinence-only education. And there's a lot of people who look at those numbers and say, you know, you can't sort of force nature out of people. Mm-hmm. But Reverend, what would you say to that?
Well, I would say that in a lot of our churches and a lot of our Christian environments in particular, but not exclusively, I'll just call it our religious environments, we do create a stigma around sex. And when you create this stigma, you create curiosity. And when you allow curiosity to just be unfettered, it does result in certain things that may that I perceive as maybe unwanted. The fact that you would give less funding for abstinence and have lower rates, that does maybe portend to the fact that there is more information out there for kids. Are condoms going to be available and these sorts of things? That's part of the education process, right? And I'm not opposed to informing kids of the mechanics of sex and how it works and the use of condoms, and maybe that does lower the rate of unwanted teen pregnancies. And I think it all revolves around how we approach the discussion. We don't want to make sex as something that's dirty. Sex is something that's beautiful. Sex is something that is in the intended relationships with which it exists. It is something to be celebrated. And I think if kids understood that and understood that in a deeper way in the context and the purpose for it, we'd go a lot longer way to preventing some of these types of unwanted things.
All right, listeners, you can hear a lot more of Dan Errol's view on that in Parenting Without God, his book. He's on the line with us. We only got about 4 minutes left. Every phone line filled. I'm going to try to move quickly. Joel, Rochester. Go ahead, Joel.
This might be a little late in the game, but I wanted to talk about the definition of critical thinking because it keeps coming up again in this discussion. And for me, critical thinking involves hunting for our assumptions, then testing the validity of those assumptions, then thirdly, you know, looking at our assumptions from multiple points of view and perspectives, and then lastly, some sort of informed action. And I'm afraid that when we get stuck on the testing of our assumptions and don't move beyond that, some things kind of fall apart. And so I'd like the guests to briefly talk about what do they mean by critical thinking when they talk about critical thinking.
All right. So Joel's describing pretty close to the Socratic method. Dr. Letterman, what would you say to that?
Well, first of all, thank you. That was a great, nice, succinct definition of critical thinking that I think is really helpful for today's discussion. And I think he's absolutely right. When we get stuck on one of those pieces, conversation gets off, you lose conversation. I think one of the important things that he touched on was this looking at one's own assumptions, testing it, looking at it from different perspectives. I think that really feeds into what we started with today. And I think where Dan and Reverend Sittig and I are in so much agreement that kind of a process is what we want to see happening, no matter which assumptions we're starting with. So if you're starting with religious assumptions or with non-religious assumptions, do you go through a critical thinking process that allows you to circle back to those assumptions and explore them from different perspectives?
Okay, Dan Errol, go ahead.
I agree. yeah, he pretty much almost nailed the Socratic method, and that's almost my perfect definition of critical thinking.
All right. Last comment is going to come from Mary Jane in Webster. And Mary Jane, you got to do it in 30 seconds or less. Go ahead.
Well, I'll start out by saying as a child, I learned God is love. And as I began to consider that through my lifetime and my studies of Jesus, I found that that is the way, and I have tried to live a life of love that has led to a life of peace that passes understanding.
Mary Jane, I wish your message could be heard by everyone in the world today, especially when we see headlines around the world and the kinds of stories we've had to cover. And we're almost out of time here. Dan Errol, it's your fault that we had this discussion. You're the one who wrote the book Parenting Without God, How to Raise Moral, Ethical, and Intelligent Children Free from Religious Dogma. We got through such a small amount of comments. I mean, I can't even tell you. And I'll share with my guests offline the emails and everything. It's just really remarkable what's come in. So, Dan, you've touched a nerve with this book. So I'll give you the last word on what you want to leave our listeners with. Go ahead.
Be open-minded. Let your children question you and everything else. Welcome the questions. Encourage the questions. And never demand that your child be what you want them to be. Let them be who they are.
Yeah, it's a sort of a beautiful sentiment, and we've got even some nods from our guests in the room here. And Reverend Scott Sittig told me before the hour began, we're going to agree on more than people think. And I think that was largely true. Scott's the lead pastor at New Hope Free Methodist Church. Thank you for being here, Reverend.
Thank you.
Dr. Rebecca Letterman, an associate professor of spiritual formation at Northeastern Seminary. Thank you for being here. And Dan Errol, we'll find you online where? I've seen you on Twitter in many places. Where are you online, Dan?
Easily find me at danerroll.com and Twitter at danerroll.
A-R-E-L. Thank you for taking the time to join the conversation as well, Dan. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for all of our listeners today. A very busy Thursday afternoon. Hope you have a great one, and we'll come back and talk to you tomorrow. In fact, we're going to talk to members of the Islamic community. They have canceled a peace rally tomorrow that was scheduled, if you were interested in that. But we're going to talk to them about why in our first hour. We'll talk with you then. Have a great afternoon.